Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart A. Cuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
My name is Angelo Carasone, better known as Stop Back on Twitter, and primarily I spend my time trying to debunk right-wing lies that permeate our media, and there's, you know, one of the places that we do it is on Bob Carson's show.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013. And you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour. And I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hi, this is David Levitt, your host from SYM Radio. SYM Radio is helping raise awareness to missing persons, parental stranger abductions, and human trafficking through our partners. We also raise awareness that people with disabilities can do whatever they set their mind to through the love of God and Christ. And we're proud to be an affiliate with Carson's Corner, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Jay Ray and Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio and also at symradio.com/live.
Hi there. This is Justin Ray Harvey of Jay Ray Radio and the co-host of Carson's Corner with Bob Carson. We have an announcement. We are no longer affiliated with Underground Progressive Radio 5:30 a.m. Even though we've had a critical change in the programming, our programming will remain the same. Times are subject to change, so just sit back and enjoy the program as you normally would. The only change is we've grown bigger and better, and like I said, we no longer support or advertise Underground Progressive Radio 5:30 a.m. in any way. Thank you and show some respect.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it, too. I encourage you to listen.
All right, we're back live here on Carson's Corner. Hopefully, we have resolved the audio problems. I want to bring on our first guest of the evening, Glenn Langor. Glenn, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. I think we had some audio problems earlier, so you probably heard some dead air on my part. I just want to just introduce you to the audience out there because I don't think they heard my introduction. Glenn Langor, ladies and gentlemen, is an author. He's written several books about the prison system in America. Caught in the Crossfire, Life in Lockdown is one of his books. And he spent I believe he spent about a decade in prison, 4 years in solitary confinement. And so he really has become an expert on the penal system in America. And this is a real, real exciting interview for us because we get to hear from someone that has had a very, very interesting life. And like I said, he's released several books. Roll Call, A True Prison Story. Folks can find out information about his books and some of his other activity. We'll discuss websites and anything out there that can lead you to Glenn's work. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it. I just kind of want to start off with your journey and whatnot. How did you end up in prison? You know, just give us kind of the bio, if you would.
I'm hypersensitive. I have ADHD. And then I have two good parents that got divorced when I was 12 years old, and I did not handle the divorce well at all. And I ended up running away from home, and I got involved in drugs. It was really innocent at first. I stayed in a smuggler's garage. I slept in his garage, and he had trash cans full of marijuana. And I got ideas and went to the border of Mexico to National City and got a bigger dealer to deal to him. And that got me pretty much self-contained, and my brother ended up running away also. And we ended up doing okay until about 18 years old when the police interrupted that program and seized probably about $30,000 in all our marijuana and our little grow system. And this was in like 1990. And so I had already a bunch of rage on my shoulders, and now I had even more rage. They just took all my money. And so I tried to make that money back, got involved in methamphetamine, in the methamphetamine trade in San Bernardino, and corralled the best methamphetamine cook of the time back then, and ended up getting involved with bikers, Mexican mobsters, all having to do with meth and marijuana, trying to make all that money back, and stayed on that course for way too long.
And that ultimately, obviously, led you. What was... So, you know, you had a difficult childhood. You didn't handle your parents' divorce well. And, you know, sometimes we see that a lot of times that happens is that, you know, something happens that maybe shouldn't happen in a childhood. And a child without the proper guidance kind of goes, you know, down the wrong path and winds up in prison. And it's good ultimately that you turned your life around and now you can educate people about, you know, what is going on in the prison system and you know, things regarding the drug war and whatnot.
Yes.
Tell us about your experience. I mean, what was it like for you to actually go in prison?
Well, what I like to, you know, write about and talk about in interviews and stuff is when you're in jail, and like I mentioned, I had some ADHD, some mental stuff, you know, as childhood, and then addiction stuff, and you're in jail, it's survival. And it's the first thing you're worried about is what race is going to riot today. So it's an all survival system, and there's no rehabilitation. There's nothing to help you with any kind of addiction or any kind of mental issues or how about any poverty issues where how are you going to get out and maintain when you get out. So it's really just survival of the fittest in there. It's a gang-producing area because when you're in fear for how you're going to survive, you know, that's when gangs and tattoos and pressure and stuff like that starts happening. So what I like to point out is that by locking up so many low-level criminals, whether it's poverty crimes, property crimes, drug crimes, we're breeding an addiction and an affliction that's much harder to escape because you get out with worse issues and now you have, you know, no job, no place to live. So that's what a lot of my writing points to, is that, you know, the system breeds a bigger problem by the way we're locking everybody up with this tough on crime stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the United States prison population outnumbers far any other country. I mean, I think we have more people in prison in the United States than the world does combined. And, you know, I point out that part of the reason why I think we have such a huge prison population is because somewhere along the line, it's financially profitable. We have, you know, companies like Black and Hunt, Corrections Corporation of America. They're trading their stocks on the market, and the more people they lock up, the more money they make, and it's really unfortunate.
You got that right. In California alone, we have more people incarcerated than any other country other than China. So that's just another way to look at it. I spent the 4 years in solitary because it is survival of the fittest in there, involved in a couple small-time riots, nothing huge. I was under investigations. Now, I never got any tattoos. I never bent at all and joined gangs or any of that. But I took leadership roles to try to, you know, be diplomatic with other races and relations, Mexican mobsters, blacks, Crips, all that stuff. And just because of that, trying to keep the peace on yards, I got thrown in the hole for investigations and stuff. So the whole system's just, it's broken. And you're right. It's as much money orientated and driven as as it is tough on crime stuff. Like I remember, while I was fighting a case in the mid '90s that culminated in my drug war career, I ended up getting conned by a guy who was building custom Harley Davidsons, and I put $12,005 into it. And he was trying to tell me, he knew my childhood and he knew I had some abuse as a child. And he was trying to tell me, well, get out of the drug war and invest into my Harleys. So I thought he was like another father figure, and I invested. And turns out he was scamming me because he knew I was a drug dealer. And he alleged that I collected and extorted him. And so anyway, Orange County jumped all over that, almost charged me with organized crime charges, the building blocks for it. And at the time, it was Michael Capizzi that was a district attorney, and he wanted that 99% conviction ratio because he had aspirations to be state attorney general like Janet Reno at the time. And so it's as much tough on crime to get elected and to stay elected as it is the money aspect that you're mentioning, because nobody wants to look soft on crime. And he was in charge of my case, and, I had a high-powered attorney. I put a lot of money into him, and he told me, he goes, if you're not over 50 years old, rich and Republican in Orange County, they don't want you. I cannot defend you. You're being railroaded. I have to work with these guys. These are the words he said to me. And so I was like, wow, look at the system I'm in. And I made them give me half my money back, took a plea bargain. They ended up dropping all the heavy stuff and just a drug case. And so that's what roll call's about. A lot of what roll call's about, but that's the system that we have to deal with right now.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I kind of wanted to go into roll call a little bit, but I want to kind of build off of something that you said because in certain states, Mississippi, I believe, is one of them, and other states in the South, I think maybe even Texas. There have been some state governments that have actually taken the private companies in charge of prisons and just passed it off to the state because we in the United States, there's a rush to privatize many industries and prison obviously being one of them, where if you privatize mm-hmm. industry, the company in charge ultimately makes more money by administering less services. And I heard horror stories about what the prisoners in some penitentiaries in Mississippi and other states across the country have to go through because, these corporations want to just cut services and it ultimately becomes worse for the prisons, the prisoners. And so, what type of treatment have you received? What type of horrors can you talk about when it comes to how our prison systems are run? I mean, I can only imagine how difficult, some of the time must have been.
Yeah. I was in the late 90s, during that period I told you about where I was fighting that case, I sat in the county for a little over a year fighting the case. I went to prison. I went to a Northern California prison, and there was hardly any whites at all. I mean, there's just not that many whites. And the way the yard there was set up is the whites and the Southern Mexicans had the same half of the building, used the same showers and so forth. So we hung out with them. That doesn't mean I was one of them. It just means I hung out with them. Well, they ended up being heavily outnumbered by the Northern Mexicans in a riot. And since we hung out with them, myself and one other white guy who happened to be from San Francisco, this is the book I wrote called Prison Riot. We helped them out because we just didn't want to watch them get outnumbered. And it took a day and a half to get to the hole. Well, when we get to the hole, we overflowed a building because there wasn't enough room for the regular hole to fit the whole yard that went off building by building like a domino. So it took a day and a half to get there, and we're exhausted. And so we're yelling up to our upstairs cell above us through the vent saying, hey, can you guys help us out with any tobacco, or can you help us out with any food, any cosmetics? And we're telling them where we're from. And these white guys, they come down the stairs the next day to go to yard because that half the building's still getting mainline yard. And they look at our cell, and then they come back in, and they say, hey, are you guys sure you're white? It says SM on your cell for Southern Mexican. So we're sitting there hitting up the guards, telling them, hey, we're white. We just didn't want to see these guys get outnumbered, and they were under attack on the same side that we are in the day room together with. And they didn't investigate that any further. They left Southern Mexican on our cells. We sat in the hole for about 5 months. They sent me to another prison when our shoe term expired, and that prison immediately put me in the hole again. So I sat in the hole for about 11 months because they never did their homework. I don't have any tattoos to signify anything. So that's one bad experience. Another one was on the border of Mexico where they wanted the riots to keep going. This was the blacks and Mexicans that were at war, and they wanted the riots to keep going because they got hazard pay, which is time and a half. They were able to control their hours a lot better while the yard was locked down, and they kept it going by unlocking certain cells to fight other cells to just keep it going it was ongoing for a couple of years. So that's another situation I saw that was pretty extreme. And there's many more that I could tell you about. There's the most recent book I'm writing was the hardest one to write because it's so personal. One of the guards was helping us with information, and he was a security escort, and it was good and it was bad. He was helping us with information, which helped us prepare, but it was also bad because he was giving us too much information. He gave us information about a guy who had 44 counts of child molestation. And so you can imagine what happens to a child molester in there. So that kind of like put all the pressure on me to make sure it was dealt with properly. So it's just horror stories like that. Where do you get any rehabilitation when it's all about survival and stuff like that? I mean, it's literally in California, and I'm pretty sure it's like that wherever you overcrowd people and you mix in a bunch of different races and gangs and mental issues and addictions and all that, and you overpopulate them. You know, you fill them up to the point where it's bursting at the seams. There's no rehabilitation. It's survival. So that's pretty much some of the ugly.
We're talking with author Glenn Langor here. You're absolutely right. And recently, California now, because of some court decisions and because of the overcrowding that you're talking about, they're having to release a lot of people into the community because there's just no room. And you know, the thing about it is that in our society, and it's really unfortunate, I think in some cases, where once you've gone to prison, once you have a felony on your record, it's almost as if you're not fully in the eyes of the law a citizen. You, in many states, you lose your right to vote. And you know, you almost have no recourse while in prison. I mean, I know someone right now, my friend Dan Quinn. He's in Sacramento County. He's waiting trial right now. He's been in there a year now, and this is a gun possession case. And there's no telling when he's going to be able to get a trial. And he's described all sorts of instances similar, not on the scale of what you've experienced, but similar. In terms of the guards and in terms of the treatment there, and you know, on and on and on, putting him in a cell with someone that was convicted for murder or on trial for murder and has gang affiliations when Dan is, you know, he's not a violent felon. And it just seems like, what recourse do you have in that environment when all you can do is just survive?
Yeah, and see, you're mentioning that friend of yours that's in there with a gang, a known affiliate or a known gang member, murder and all that. You can be targeted and tagged as a gang member affiliate just for being in the cell with them. So they can use that against you to stick you in solitary. And you're mentioning the overcrowding. I don't want to sound like a sage or anything or predict anything, but I mean, come on, it's pretty obvious that the property crimes are going to go up when they have to release 10,000 people. And of course, the governor's going to look like, oh, see, I tried to avoid it. But, I mean, that's the end result when you stick too many people in there for petty crimes, and now they're, like I said, they're going to have a harder time mentally coming out. It's like coming out of a war zone. It's like military people come back, and they're changed. It's the same thing. So, I mean, of course you can expect the crime rate to go up, property crimes, because you run out of your $200 gate money. You have nowhere to live, and you end up having to hustle in a hotel just to survive. So it's unfortunate that, that's probably what's going to happen. The hunger strike in California right now, these guys haven't eaten for almost 30 days. And here's one thing the media is not pointing out. These guys have broke color lines, and they've united together in a peaceful hunger strike for five core demands. The first one is the validation process. I was mentioning how they put me in there and never, you know, investigated that I'm not a Southern Mexican. They can keep you in there forever indefinitely based on bad information like that. There's no court system. Their other demands end with, we need rehabilitation. We want to be able to go to school. We want to be able to do stuff while we're in solitary. It's just an ugly situation, and the media is not really picking up on it the right way.
No, and that's part of the problem, because obviously the media is comprised of corporations that, you know, are in some way connected to, you know, the corporations that run the prison systems. And we don't have any money. We don't have money for this. We don't have money for that. But in actuality, you know, I can guarantee you look at the state budgets, and you could see a lot of money going to, you know, this corporation, that corporation, and, you know, we've just fill in the blank. It's just unfortunate. It really is. But I think that I commend them for engaging in the hunger strike, similar to what we're seeing in Guantanamo Bay. And it takes such extreme actions to have any type of media awareness. It's really courageous what we're seeing.
And there are a bunch of saints involved in platforming as much as they can to shine a light on those five core demands and in the injustice and all that. And there's a lot of prayer warriors out there. So I'm very glad to be somewhat a part of that. I wrote a book called Underdog that really shines a light on the five core demands, how that they can get it wrong. Another riot I was involved in over a drug debt that got out of control. I show how one of the guys that was involved got targeted because of some tattoos they couldn't even understand. So they decided he was the shot caller, stuck him in the hole, sent him to Pelican Bay. And so I was able to flesh that out. But there are people that are doing their best. A lot of people out there are doing their best to shine a light on it.
I want to talk about what leads people to prison. We touched upon this a little earlier, but in the United States of America, the United States is actually one of the last ranking countries in terms of upwards mobility, meaning the family that you're born into in terms of socioeconomic class is most likely where you're going to end up as an adult. And on top of this, you know, for the last 30 plus years or pretty much forever, we get sold in the corporate media about the American dream, where if you work hard and you do the right things, somehow, you know, you could rise above poverty and you could start your own business and you could really prosper. But if you look at the prison system, I would be really convinced that almost all the people that you were in prison with came from dysfunctional families, came from, you know, poverty-ridden families and in poverty-ridden areas, which didn't create a lot of economic opportunity, and therefore, you know, prison may be a generational thing with them. You know, in the United States, we've industrialized. We no longer have a manufacturing base, and it just makes it that much harder for everybody in poverty. And so my question to you is there some sort of a generational link between parents and their children in terms of where they end up in life based on your experience in the prison population?
Absolutely. I bring up that, you know, during the 60s when it was free love, free, you know, you could do what you wanted, you could mess with drugs, you could free love, all that. They didn't have the war on drugs. You know, a lot of those people, you know, played with the drugs and stuff like that, got out of it and became politicians. Somewhere along the line, you know, some of them did, somewhere along the line, the war on drugs, and that's a war on people, that's a war on addiction. And for the most part, you're right. I've actually seen people that are rich. In Orange County, it's just so tough on crime that it's sending mostly white people and Mexicans. We don't have as many blacks here. So, but I do agree with you that it is a cultural phenomenon. The tough on crime platforms of the late 80s, early 90s, just lock them up. Don't let them back out. The fear-based stuff. We have to be tough on these guys. And they lost the idea of smart on crime. Smart on crime is don't let a child molester molest more than once. keep them in there forever when it's a heavy child molestation. Same thing with rape. Same thing with murder. Same thing with robbery. There are certain crimes, yes, you have to be hard on. And we have to protect, you know, the kids. And we have to protect the communities. But drugs and property crimes where somebody just can't make it, those are the kind of there's a book I'm working on that I already wrote that I'm trying to turn into a TV show that's about addiction and recovery called My Heart is Step. And I just interviewed a girl for a little casting call, and she's gone through the prison system, and she's battled mental stuff, bipolar stuff like that, mostly drug addict crimes, and the prison system did not help her. This program called WIT, Whatever It Takes, that helped her. That gave her a place to live in Santa Ana. It's a little lower level economy over there, and she got back on her feet, and it's a drug program in. It's not prison. Instead of prison, she chose that. It was like 18 months, and she's doing fantastic. She's got her kid back, and so this is an example of what you can do other than prison. Now, what you mentioned about not having enough money for it, yeah, they don't really want to spend the money on that. Like, anytime the budgets come up and they don't have it, that program can get shot out. So there are alternatives that do work. Her probation officer is so excited with finding out about me in the book and her casting call that, you know, it's like I'm platforming the law for the first time in my life, and she's platforming an ex-convict, so it's kind of cool.
Well, it's great that you're doing this. You're raising awareness as far as alternatives to prison because, you know, I would be willing to bet that a majority of prisoners in America are there on drug-related offenses. And, you know,
70%.
There's a huge – yeah, I mean, that's amazing. And you know, you look at something like marijuana, and this is I'd like to really get your opinion on this. Really become a political issue, really over the last 15, 20 years, maybe even before that. But certainly, it's a political issue now, and we're starting to have a debate about whether or not the effects of marijuana are really do they warrant the prison sentences that we see? And you look at things that are perfectly legal, like alcohol, cigarettes, tobacco. Yeah. Addictions to alcohol and addictions to cigarettes and addictions to profit. I mean, look at Wall Street and their addiction to speculation and profit. We know the personalities that exist on Wall Street. These addictions are rewarded, and yet, you know, marijuana, I don't know if you could be addicted to marijuana, but possession of marijuana and sort of selling it is penalized. There's a real problem with that. It's a real contradiction there.
Well, we look at addiction now like alcoholism. Like all our medical profession looks at it like it's a disease. So you treat a disease. You don't put somebody with a disease in prison. And you're right about the addiction stuff. Now, medical marijuana is now legal over here. So it's like, man, that's what I got in trouble for the first time. And now it's legal. So it's like, can I have the money back you guys seized? No, but you're right. It's a huge problem. You're right. You nailed it.
I wonder
we're on living. We're having a real epidemic with the pharmaceuticals handing out Oxycontins, which is heroin, other things that you mix with those that kill you, Xanax for anxiety, and it's the kids in school are figuring out how to game the pharmaceuticals. Oh, well, you know, tell them that it didn't work for your back and this and that. It starts with the medical marijuana. It goes to the Oxycontin and the Xanax. And the kids over here are dying all the time because they're mixing some of those legal drugs that the pharmaceuticals are making really accessible to kids in high school. I don't know if that's happening where you're at, but that's we have an epidemic over here.
It is. And it's in some places throughout the United States. I mean, there are some counties where it's absolutely dire. It seems like the drug culture has shifted to, you know, what's maybe from heroin, shooting heroin, to popping pills now. And these pills are a lot stronger than many of the more traditionally classified drugs. And that's really unfortunate. And it comes back to, you know, the pharmaceutical companies and how they essentially use the government for research. They use the government to provide patents for their research. They use government facilities. They partner up, and they have a basic monopoly on the drug industry. So something like marijuana, which I've never smoked marijuana, but from my understanding, there's not a whole lot of evidence that people that use marijuana are going to be prone to accidents or violent behavior. Marijuana is seen as a threat to the profit of these drug companies, and it people that are in possession of marijuana are sentenced to jail, and it's just unfortunate.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I don't think any mind altering substance is good at all. You know, I'm very spiritual. I'm in church all the time, and that's part of my recovery. Part of dealing with all the mental stuff I've seen and gone through is church. So I would never want to platform any mind altering substance at all. But I can tell you from experience that marijuana, I mean, when I was on high control parole and I turned in, this is a long time ago, and I turned in a dirty test, my parole officer said, you know what, I don't mind when you're smoking that because I know you're not going to be committing crimes. So marijuana is more of a peaceful relaxation type thing, but it has its drawbacks too. It attaches to the brain, the fat cells in your body, and your brain has a lot of fat cells. So it's definitely not something I would want to promote. But I'm promoting compassion with the drug war. I mean, really, drugs are legal. Like we just mentioned, the pharmaceuticals, if you know how to go about it the right way, you can get heroin, you can get speed, you can get cocaine from the pharmaceuticals if you know how to go about it the right way. In Mexico, when I was in prison on the border of Mexico in Imperial Valley, we'd hear FAM Baja California, and they would go into telling you that it's legal to have up to an ounce of drugs. You just cannot bring them to sporting events, and you cannot sell them. They've got the right idea over there. You do not incarcerate people. You do not make it illegal, because now you create that underground culture. You create that allure. I don't know what to do with this drug war. I just think that we have to be more compassionate, have a lot more common sense, and realize that, hey, it's breeding more gangs. It's breeding more cartel violence, and, it's breeding an addiction into an affliction much harder to escape when you lock up everybody for drug crimes.
We're talking with author Glenn Langor here. Glenn, how many books have you written?
I wrote Roll Call, which is a long novel. Upon Release is the sequel, and then I got some really good feedback. Kirkus Discoveries, Nielsen Media related Roll Call to the movie Traffic in the first line. My wife's father, John South from American Media, said focus on the prison stuff, so I wrote Race Riots, Lockup Diaries, Gladiator. These are all smaller ones. Underdog is one of my favorite ones because it gets into that hunger strike. Prison Riot is about the riot I was in where they thought I was Mexican and I'm not. After that, Caught in the Crossfire is the one you featured. How to Make Prison Weapons is the next one. And the next one after that is the most shocking, and that's called The Art of War, a prison memoir. And that gets into where that security escort told us about a child molester, and it's just pretty crazy. So those are all my prison books. I actually started writing prayer books because I didn't know if I was honoring God with all this stuff, and my marriage was on the rocks, so I started writing some prayer books, and God showed me that I can write other stuff. And then he showed me that, hey, you know what, why don't you help other people in addiction? So I wrote a book called My Heart is Step, which is think intervention on TV, but with a lot more recovery. It's 12-step based, so it goes over people's hardest step. I am really blessed to have a sobriety sponsor by the name of Phil Duran, who's an ex-TV producer. And so he's helped me get through a lot of my stuff. And so that's what the book's based on, but then at the very end, I end up helping other people getting out of prison, gang members, stuff like that, to deal with their hardest step at recovering from all of the above.
Yeah, I mean, did you start writing in prison, or was it after you got out you really started?
Yes, sir. No, sir. I had trial transcripts going back to that case I told you where they tried to get me for organized crime charges, fortifying a criminal enterprise, which is the building blocks for organized crime. I had, I don't know, about 8 inches thick of trial transcripts from sitting in the county for a long time and taking everything as far as you have to take it to finally get them to come down off of the ridiculousness. And I used the back of those trial transcripts, and I woke up at 4 a.m. before the politics and survival of prison life invaded my mind, and I'd write. And then I'd deal with prison politics and life, and then back in the cell I'd write. And every time we were locked down, I was glad because I'd get to write nonstop and not have to worry about dealing with Mexican mobsters and Crips and Bloods and all the stuff that goes on with, you know, creating drug debt policies so that people don't cause race riots over drugs. So I wrote for 7 years to write Roll Call. When I got out, I had help rewriting it. a college professor took me under the wing and told me how to rewrite it through the character's eyes, and that took my writing to a whole other level. And I've just hung on to writing as therapy the whole time. So I've been out for 5 years. I'm off parole. I'm off everything. And I've been writing nonstop.
Well, that's great. I mean, I think that your writing has tremendous value, what you're doing, and people can really learn from that. And if we could start to look to some alternative methods in terms of treating people as opposed to,
yes,
you know, just locking people up. I mean, I remember, you know, during, it was Reagan, I think. It was Reagan that closed all the,
yes,
mental facilities out there. And as a result, you have places like Skid Row in California and other
exactly
places that are just filled with people that really should be in mental institutions.
Exactly. Another thing, it's almost impossible to get a job when you get out of,
yeah,
prison with any felonies, with that background. It's almost impossible to get a job, and you know how tough the job market already is.
Yeah, and you know, it was, I forget, one president, I think it was, I don't know, it was Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said that the best welfare program is a job, that the best thing we could do to prevent crime is to provide American jobs. And that doesn't seem to be the case here, and it doesn't seem like we're going to get that back for a long time, if we ever get it back. You know, our economic policies definitely breed crime. There's no question about it. We just do not see this in other industrialized countries. You don't see the level of incarceration. You don't see, even though crime is declining in the United States, we've deindustrialized, and that has really hurt us.
Yes, agree. Agreed.
Give people your website and how they can, if people go in the chat room, they can.
If anybody leaves comments or anything like that on your blog or anything to do with you, I will gift them out Kindle copies of my books. They can find me on Amazon under Glenn Langohr, G-L-E-N-N, Langohr, L-A-N-G-O-H-R. I have a couple websites I built that are pretty ghetto. One of them is lockdownpublishing.com, all one word. Facebook me, and I'll gift you out Kindle copies. All my books are in print Kindle, which is the immediate download, and audiobook. I'm having fun putting them all into audiobook, speaking as if I'm a Mexican or a prison guard, and everybody down, 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 life route's coming next, boom. So I have fun putting audiobooks together, and I'll gift them out also if people leave reviews. So they can find me at lockdownpublishing.com or Glenn Langohr, G-L-E-N-N, Langohr, L-A-N-G-O-H-R. And if they leave a comment on your page, I'll gift them out Kindle copies.
Well, Glenn, let's do this again. This is fun. This is a great discussion. Thank you for all your work, and we'll talk to you sometime down the road, my friend.
Okay, thank you, and God bless.
Take care, brother.
All right, thank you.
All right, that was Glenn Langohr here on Carson's Corner. Make sure to check out his work. GlennLangohr.com, I believe, is the website, and you know, if you can, get his books on Amazon.com. It's really, really interesting stuff. It's great. It really is to see somebody that's trying to do something good out there now, trying to raise awareness. And, you know, I can only think of my friend, Ben Quinn, who's right now in Sacramento County. And, you know, it's we need to really reevaluate how we look at how we, you know, pursue penalties and how we have a quote war on crime and war on drugs. I don't necessarily think that's working, but somewhere along the line, somebody's making money off of it, so it doesn't have to be too terribly efficient. You know, as I pointed to earlier in the interview, these corporations like Black and Hyde Corrections Corporation of America, and I'm sure other private prison corporations or they may even be publicly traded. They're making money based on the amount of people that they lock up. And these people that they lock up, they don't necessarily have to go for treatment. They don't necessarily have to be really cured from addiction. They just have to be locked up. It just doesn't matter. So it's almost a model based on inefficiency, okay? That the more people these corporations lock up, the more money they make. And it's unfortunate because that doesn't necessarily create value for society, okay? What creates value for society is having these individuals get off of drugs, okay, and become, you know, functioning members of society, contribute to society, go get a job, you know, give back to the community. And that's what it's got to be all about, as opposed to punishment. And I think we're starting to evolve, but you know what? It's going to take a long time. It really is. And I think it's going to take a revolution on all fronts to make sure that we change. We really need one. My name is Bob Carson. This is Carson's Corner. J. Ray was supposed to call in, but he messaged me saying he had a late supper. I hate when people use the word supper. I don't know what it is. I just hate that word. I never use that. Because I never really had any dinners with my family. I never did. So he'll be calling probably in the second hour or so. We don't really have a lot to talk about on the political front. Congress has gone into recess. It's their fifth recess of the year, I believe, or something like that. You know, after every season, they go on recess. It's just disgusting. It really is. These people, they really do nothing, the politicians. They are not elected to change things. They're elected to keep things the way they are. And they go for 5 weeks, go back to their districts and whatever they have to do, without passing legislation to make our lives easier. In fact, one can argue that our Congress is put there to make our lives more difficult. Our Congress is put there to serve the business interests. And Noam Chomsky has written about this, and I'm reading one of his books called Understanding Power. And he talks about how the government is just one area, one segment of power. The real power exists in private interests. The very interests that Glenn and I were talking about that are driving our inefficient, wasteful prison system in America. I mean, just go back to what Glenn was talking about, how the riots, where you had riots and the guards understood that it would be considered hazardous pay and they could make more money when, you know, the prison is in a state of rioting, when there's constant violence within the prison system. Well, ultimately, the taxpayers are probably going to have to pay for that. You know, I can almost guarantee you that somewhere along the line, the taxpayers are going to have to pay for the hazardous pay of the corrections officers. And that in turn means more money for the corporation and, you know, less money there is to fund schools, less money there is to rebuild roads, tunnels, fill in the blank. And that is the problem. That's what we're seeing right now, is that it's a cycle of disinvestment. It's where, you know, our politicians spend a lot of time raising money from the very wealthy, so they only hear their concerns, and the very wealthy are only interested in investing in something that's going to make them more money in the future. And, you know, things like public transportation, things like the public school systems, you know, just fill in the blank. They don't want their tax dollars to go to these institutions because they don't rely on them. So the government has really been on this privatization rampage over the last 30 plus years. And we've privatized every industry now to the point where nobody can understand, nobody could tell where the private sector begins and the government ends, or vice versa. And that is like that on purpose. That is like that because the true segment of power, the powerful interests that control the system and are maintaining the system, they've infiltrated the government. And that's why you have it. That's why you have the cycle of disinvestment, where things cannot be funded anymore. You know, we don't have money to fix our roads. We don't have money to fix our schools. We don't have money to, you know, do whatever. But when it comes to building prison, yeah, we have money to build prison because it's going into the pockets of the private industry. So wherever there's a business plan, wherever there's a profit to be made, there's always money going into that area because that's the nature of our current form of capitalism. And I'm telling you, folks, our current form of capitalism is a complete disaster. It really is. This economic system is not serving the interests of the vast majority of Americans. And we're seeing numbers like right now, you know, 80% of Americans at some point in their life are going to be near poverty. 80% of Americans. And you can bet your bottom dollar that 80% of Americans, doesn't include the 1% of Americans who control the vast majority of the nation's wealth and income. And, you know, we were talking about this with Glenn Langor, the lack of upward mobility in America. The family you're born into ultimately determines where you're going to end up as an adult on the socioeconomic scale, because that's what our economy is like now. That's what we no longer have an economy that promotes the middle class or even establishes the middle class. We no longer have an economy that has any type of real social safety net. We have an economy that's centered around big business, okay? And when you center your economy around big business, you have a very unequal and volatile society that's susceptible to, you know, bubbles and busts. It's susceptible to a huge number of Americans living in poverty. It's susceptible to many of the social ills that have been plaguing this country. And we're at that point right now. I mean, you know, the United States of America is not the greatest place to live when you use a different yardstick to measure progress. You know, if you look at things like the GDP and the consumer price index and the unemployment rate and the stock market and corporate profits and this and that, wow. That really shows that the United States is far ahead of every country. But these indicators have nothing to do with the social well-being of Americans. They don't correlate at all to our well-being. In fact, as these numbers go up, as the stock market goes up, as corporate profits go up, as the very wealthy get wealthier, our lives become worse. And that's something that we have to understand here, folks. That's one of the reasons why I do this radio show each week, because if you understand that when business is doing well, doing very well as they're doing, when corporate profits are through the roof, when you have the average CEO making 300 or 400 times more than the lowest paid worker, that is coming from somewhere, okay? We have a finite money supply, and if all of the money or most of the money is going to a small percentage of Americans, that means it's coming from us. We're giving them our money in abstraction, and that's what happens. That's what's happening. You're in debt right now. Okay, you're working two or three jobs like I am. You're giving money to the individuals that own the means of production. You are working more jobs so they don't have to pay you the wage that you deserve. You see, I mean, everything is. There's a relationship between everything. You know, you have a high number of Americans that are living in poverty. You have a high childhood poverty. Well, that means that somebody else is benefiting from that. Some segment of the population. And that's how we have to start looking at things, where we have to look at business and who controls the political system and how they're benefiting. And then from there, you could go and you could enact change, because, you know, if one sector of the economy is benefiting and all the other sectors are seeing their quality of life deteriorate, well, then you have to change. You have to change it and take the power away from the segment of the population that is benefiting. And that's just the bottom line, folks. We have to stop watching sports. Sports are a disaster. Okay, I don't watch sports, and I encourage you not to watch sports, because sports are given to us to allow us to consent to power, to distract us and allow us to consent to power. And you know, you could talk to somebody, you can go down the street and you could talk to somebody, and they'll tell you everything you need to know about the local sports team and how, you know, whatever area they come from. If they come from Philadelphia or New York City, they rank the place of the local sports team, professional sports team, as being important to society. These, you know, we need to get them in the opposite direction. We need to say, listen, instead of focusing on sports, okay, which really provides no, I would say, value, or certainly in my life. Okay, I don't care if Michael Jordan or somebody can dunk a basketball. I'll never be able to do that. The vast majority of Americans won't be able to do that. Okay, and it's like, you know, who cares? Everybody dreams of being a sports star when they're a child. They do. And then somewhere along the line, they realize that that's not possible. And so, you know, we just have to realize that sports really don't affect our lives. In fact, you know, if you look at the sports team owners, David K. Johnson writes about this in one of his books, I believe it's Free Lunch, how the wealthiest Americans are using government to enrich themselves and sticking you with the bill. I hope I got the title right, but something along those lines. How, you know, you've got 27 of the 400 richest Americans that are sports team owners, okay? And sports team owners essentially suck the government dry by threatening to move their franchise. This is a trick that they play. George W. Bush did this in Texas. They threatened to move their franchise to another city or another state unless they get a huge deal from the taxpayers to build a new stadium or build this and that. They basically take the money from the taxpayers and line their pockets and their investors. And meanwhile, the government does not have enough money to fund the school systems, all the things we talked about, the cycle of disinvestment. And that's what happens. So really, sports teams are almost, that's how I look at them, is they're almost the enemy of our society, because they're taking taxpayer dollars. They're not competing in the free market. And David K. Johnson writes about this, the antitrust exemptions that the sports teams have. And they're soaking up our tax dollars. They are. And we don't need to subsidize wealthy sports team owners. We need to rebuild America. All right. I don't know what's going on. I may play this. I'm probably going to play this interview that Jay Ray had with Peter Mahoney of Dragon Naturally Speaking. It's not a political topic, but it could be interesting to people out there. I want to encourage people to go to the CommonsProjectNetwork.com, thecommonsprojectnetwork.com. You can see other great independent progressive media content that's available. Non-corporate owned, there's no filtering system. You know, in corporate America, there's something known as a filtering system where in order to get to a certain level in the media or in any company, there's a filtering system, and you have to, you know, have certain values. You can't be an independent thinker. You can't question the very power structure. And there's just certain do's and don'ts. And if you aren't that ideal candidate, then you're not going to get, you know, a platform, because you have to uphold the system and further the system. It's something that Noam Chomsky talks about. So, you know, you get these idiot journalists like David Gregory and other people that say, oh, nobody tells me what to write. Yeah, well, yeah, nobody tells you what to write because the corporation you work for knows what you're going to write already, and they've approved what you're going to write already, or else you wouldn't be working for them, and or else you know, the advertisers aren't going to continue. It's all a game. It's all a game. A wise comedian once said the corporations or the media is only as liberal as the corporations that own it. And remember that. And remember, that's all the more incentive to listen to shows like this. Actually, we're going to take a brief time out, and when we come back, I'm going to play you this interview that Jerry did with Peter Mahoney.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
Blog Talk Radio.
And you listen to my good friend, Justin Ray Harvey, on J-Ray Radio.
This is Gordon Ricusa, author of Shidoshi, The Four Ways of the Corpse, and The Five Principles of Everything. Getting my facts straight from Justin Ray Harvey.
This is Stan Bush. I sing Fight to Survive in the movie Bloodsport. You're listening to Justin Ray Harvey.
Hi, this is Tony Luke Jr., a.k.a. Joey the Nail Nardone, and you're listening to Justin Ray Harvey.
Hey, everyone, it's Rick Reiser from the Days of Music 103 CIR in Beckley, West Virginia. You're listening to my boy Justin Ray Harvey on J. Ray Radio.
Hi, I'm Tony Luke Jr., also known as Joey the Nail. Please follow my friend Justin Ray Harvey on Facebook, Twitter, and Skype. His tag is at Justin Harvey. He's a great guy. I follow him, and I know you'll enjoy following him, too.
Hi, this is Peter Mahoney, Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer at Nuance Communications. I'm also known as the Dragon Dictator. You're listening to Justin Ray Harvey.
To reach Justin Harvey's studio line, please call 818-532-9762.
Hi, this is Raven Kane, the co-founder of Pain, Progressive Action, Immediate Neutralization, and the singer-songwriter for the new record called Six String Revolver. You're listening to my good friend Justin Ray Harvey. He's a fellow martial artist and a good man. And if you even consider turning the show off, I'll come through this internet connection and choke your ass out.
Yes, we are live on J. Ray Radio. I am your host, Justin Ray Harvey. And, folks, I hope that you are ready to talk dragon because that will be our subject for this evening's topic. And without further ado, let me bring on our special guest, Senior Vice President of Nuance, legendary Peter Mahoney. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Justin.
Hi,
my friend. I sure am.
Hi there.
Great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. I wanted to say a special thank you for the intro that you made and the time that you've taken out of your enormous busy schedule just to be on my show. So.
Well, absolutely. This is you kidding with your following, with this great show, and listening to those promos. It's obvious that this is the place to be, and I'm thrilled to be a guest on this very impressive show you run here, Justin.
Thank you, Peter. And I got to say that I've been wanting to talk to you for many years. That you are actually one of my heroes, Peter. So this is like. This is like a dream coming true for me to have you on this show. So.
Well, great. It's very nice of you to say, and I'm excited to be here. Love to talk dragon.
Definitely. And I guess I would like to start with, like, okay, I've used Dragon for several years. I started out with Dragon 10. Now that I've moved to a Mac, I'm on Dragon Dictation 3, which is the newer release that y'all have made. I guess where I want to start is, why did you make two different applications, and how did Dragon Dictation come about, and what's its history?
Well, it's a great question. It's kind of a long story, so let me try and give you the short one, and you can ask follow-up questions if you're interested. But Dragon, naturally speaking, has been around for a long time. It's been around for, I think 1997 was the first time that we shipped Dragon, naturally speaking. And at the time, it was actually provided by a different company. The company was called Dragon Systems. That company ended up getting sold to a Belgian company called Learnout and Housebee, and then that company went bankrupt. When that company went bankrupt, Nuance, at the time we were known as a different company, but Nuance acquired the assets of Learnout and Housebee, including Dragon, and we've been advancing the product since then. That's since about the year 2000. So now we're going on about 13 years of working with Dragon, and we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars into the development of this software. And what happened was, at the time, we always had a Windows version of the product, and we didn't make a Mac version because for a long time the market for Macs just wasn't big enough to justify the investment, because it's really expensive to build a product like this. It turned out that there was a small company called MacSpeech that made a Mac product. They had a product called iListen, and it used a different speech engine that wasn't working that well for them. So we licensed our technology to that company, MacSpeech, back probably about five, six years ago now, and they built an application on top of it. Then I turned around and bought that company. So we bought the company MacSpeech. They had a completely different app on top of it because it was built to work on the Mac versus a Windows app. So as a native Mac app, it just worked a lot differently. And then we've evolved it and tried to get it closer and closer to Dragon, naturally speaking. But they'll always be different just because the operating systems are so different.
Yeah, and I guess what you're trying to say is the challenge to get the two exactly identical is by near impossible.
Well, it's certainly, if you think about it, the Mac OS just behaves a lot differently from Windows, so certainly some of the commands that you do and some of the ways that you navigate around the operating system are just different. But what we've tried to do is get a lot of the capabilities, a lot of the core commands, and get those to be as close as possible to the Windows version of the software. The other thing to keep in mind is that we spent about a decade working on new features and new capabilities of the Windows product before the Mac one became available. So it takes time to develop those things and move the features over, so it'll get closer and closer over time, but I don't think they'll ever be completely identical. But one of the advantages of using your voice, of course, is that you should be able to use your voice in a way that really is independent from the way things look on the screen. So eventually we're going to get a lot closer between the two products.
Oh yeah, and I got to say that Dragon Dictate, I use it 100% of the time when I'm on the computer, folks. It's like if I didn't have Dragon, I would be sitting here typing with one finger for several hours, and it's just it really you know, would be agonizing to me. And if I'm thinking correctly, Peter, when Al first developed the product, weren't your target audience disabled people at first?
Well, if you look at it, it's changed over the years, Justin. And in the beginning, the first users of Dragon were people who had disabilities. The original developers built the first version. In fact, the first version, I don't know if you knew this, you needed a separate computer. So you actually needed two computers to run Dragon. And back then, and this was in the late 90s, not only did you need two computers, but the software alone cost $10,000. So it really was very, very limited in its availability to the people who needed it the most, because it was very specialized, and they had to, you know, the people who originally developed it had to get their money back for hiring all those people to develop the software. And what's really helped move it along is making it a more mainstream product. So the next set of people that used it were really doctors and lawyers, and those were the people who typed the most and or who had to create as much text as possible, but they also were used to doing dictation because that's just the way that they work. And then over the years, we've expanded and broadened it to more and more audiences, and we've tried to continue to add features that support the assistive community as much as possible, because they're, of course, the people who were the first users of Dragon.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I'm just curious, Peter, while I have you on here, where would you like to see Dragon in the next, let's say, for example, the next 10 years?
Well, I think there are a few things that we always focus on, and then there's some new things. So we always want to make it more accurate, and it's really, really accurate now, as you know, Justin, but we can always make it better, and we continue to work on that. We also want to make it as easy for people to use and as forgiving as possible. So one of the most powerful capabilities of Dragon, of course, is the ability to navigate your entire computer with your voice. So, of course, most people know that you can talk and it can do your typing for you, but the ability to actually completely control your computer with your voice is a really powerful concept, and that's still a little bit too hard in my mind. So we work pretty hard to make it easier and easier, and in fact, some of the work that we're focused on is leveraging something we call natural language processing, which is the ability for software to understand the meaning behind what you say. And if we understand the meaning of what you say, then we can be much more flexible around the kinds of commands and things you ask for. So it can be more like a personal assistant than like something that needs just very specific commands. So those are some of the things that we think are really important to make this, the full power of the technology, available to more and more people.
Wow, and I understand you guys are wrapping your hands into everything. Like, for example, speech recognition Dragon is going to be available in cars and vehicles and all this stuff. I mean, did you guys really expect this product to really take off like it has?
Well, we've been pretty pleased by it. It's been our plan, of course, for a long time. And I'm not sure how many people know, Justin, but you know, we started out on computers because they have pretty high-end processors and they're capable of handling a lot of the complex computations that are required for speech recognition to happen. And as more of these consumer electronics have gotten more and more powerful, we could put this technology in more places. But the big thing that made such a huge difference was when we took Dragon and put it in the cloud and made it a cloud capability. because that's what allows us to take mobile phones and things that might have slower processors, as an example, and allow them to have all the features and all the capability that you might have on a powerful computer. And since we've done that, you now see Dragon not only on your PC and your Mac, on smartphones, on tablets, on book readers, and in cars, and even in televisions. And so all these different applications, and you'll see it in pretty much any kind of consumer electronics, anything that's connected to the cloud, you'll be able to talk to over time.
Wow. And I've actually seen comments on Facebook and Twitter that, people love the Dragon Dictation iPhone app. It's free. And I think it's for the Android too, correct?
Yeah, there's a version on Android that's really cool called Dragon Mobile Assistant, and it's different from Dragon Dictation. We came up with Dragon Dictation, and I think if I remember correctly, it was about 2009 that we came out with Dragon Dictation. Might have been a little earlier. I'll have to look back at my records. And that was a very basic capability. It allowed you to take, at the time, it was an iPhone app that allowed you to dictate into your iPhone and convert it to text. And people saw that and thought it was magic, because you couldn't do that on a smartphone before we brought Dragon there. And of course, these days, iPhones are pretty smart and have lots of capabilities, including the Siri application, of course. It's available on new iPhones, so you can do an awful lot with that. In the Android world, though, they didn't quite have the same kind of capability. We built an app called Dragon Mobile Assistant that allows you to get really that kind of personal assistant capability with your voice on an Android device. And it's really smart. In fact, one of my favorite things about it is it's got something we call a wake-up word. That means you don't even have to touch your device. So you can just have it sitting there, and all you got to do is say, "Hey, Dragon," and it will beep and say, "How can I help you?" And you can do everything from send a text or post to Facebook to search for something, and even have it tell you what's on your calendar coming up. So it's a really powerful thing, and one of the reasons I like it is not only is it handy for people who may be driving and don't want to take their hands off the wheel, but for the assistive technology audience, it allows people, including people who have no use of no ability at all, can actually access some of this really powerful capability.
Wow, I would actually like to see like Dragon Dictation, the desktop version, kind of do like an automated voice, and you can say, "Dragon, tell me a joke," and you know.
That's right. Well, we're working on that. Believe it or not, you'll see that kind of capability in the future on PCs and Macs, more capability like that.
Wow, and like, I also had a suggestion for you guys as well.
Sure.
I know that you guys have people reading, like to train it, like for 5 minutes or what have you. But there are some people out there that cannot read and talk in a natural voice. So what I thought would be cool as a cool feature is like have Dragon physically ask you questions and then you simply just respond, and as you respond, it's training to your voice.
Well, that's a great idea. I think that makes a lot of sense. And you know, one of the things that we did, Justin, in I think it was in Dragon 11, we added the ability for it to do what we call special training. So what that does is instead of showing up and having all the words show up on the screen to do your training, and it's about 4 or 5 minutes of reading you have to do, you can basically just read as much as you can, as whatever pace you can, as many pauses that you want, and it'll be really forgiving. And just take any audio that you have, and it will train itself based on that. But I think your idea is even better. Because what that does is the problem with the way we do it today is that especially some people have difficulty either reading because they might have low vision, or they just need too much help. And this way, the people could do it, I think, a lot more independently. So I really like your idea, and I'll feed that into the product designers.
Yeah, because I've thought about it for years, because I'm actually legally blind, and I can read and stuff, but to have to read and then speak it, it's more challenging for me as a person. And when you train it, you want to be as natural as possible. And I thought, hey, why not answer questions from Dragon, like an interactive type thing,
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Also, I was reading some comments on Facebook and Twitter. I've seen that a lot of people love the Dragon Dictation app, but they're like, will we ever get a full-blown version of Dragon Dictation, like the program on the iPad itself, or would that be too difficult to do, or it's, application?
Well, here's the difference. The difference is that if think iOS, which is the operating system that that Apple has developed for iPads and iPhones, isn't really as accessible and open to third-party programs as things like Windows and even the Mac OS is. So it isn't, as a developer, all the capabilities we need are not available to us. And Apple does that for a reason, of course. They want to make sure that the operating system is really secure, which it is, and not susceptible to viruses, et cetera. And they want to make sure that they get a really great positive user experience. So part of the trade-off is that it's just a little bit more restrictive as a developer what you can do. So at this point, we can't do it. So we don't know what's going to happen with iOS in the future and whether we'd get more access to the capability. But for today, for the way that iOS works today, we really couldn't do a lot of the things that you can do on the Mac or on Windows at this point.
Wow. And I'd like to say, Peter, that, out of all the companies that I've dealt with in my lifetime, Nuance is the nicest company I've ever had the pleasure of calling or talking to. I mean, you guys are just so pleasant,
Well, that's great to hear. We try really hard. It's a little tricky, of course. We've got, of course, millions of people who use our technology, and like any big company, sometimes it's hard to find the right person. But we do try hard, and certainly if there are people who are trying to reach us and have questions, we try our best to answer them. So I'm glad you've had a good experience. But it's something that I personally spend a lot of time on, because I know we need to continue to make that better, especially as we get bigger. It's tough to keep up with the demands and all the questions that come in from our customers.
Oh, absolutely, and I gotta say, Peter, I'm a fan of your Ask the Dictator series. Can we expect any new videos in this year, possibly?
That's a great question. That was one of my favorite things that I did for a long time. And the whole idea, Justin, was when I talked to our customers, I realized that a lot of people didn't know about some of the capabilities of the product, and I realized that what we do is we give people a whole bunch of documentation, but it's pretty dense. It's a little hard to read, and I personally am not good at reading documentation. I'm just not that kind of person, and I thought if we could make really short videos to show off some of the capability, then maybe some people would learn a little bit more about the product and use it. So we decided to do this series of videos that are really only 1 or 2 minutes long, and I did one a week. And I did it for we have over 50 of them now that we've created. We took a little hiatus, but I need to get back on it, and I'll definitely do some more, because not only did I think they were really useful, but they were actually really fun to do. I enjoyed doing them.
Yeah, because Peter, they really helped me, to learn to learn Dragon Dictation, because to me, even though it's the same program, I found it at first when I had Dragon Dictation. For me, it was a learning curve, because you know, where there are different things and different sayings for Dragon Naturally Speaking, it was somewhat of a learning curve for me, but I got over that thanks to your videos. So.
Well, good. Yeah, I know a lot of people, as I said, including me, I really like to consume information that way. I think relatively short video clips are a great way to learn, and we'll definitely do some more, because I think it was a great way to do it.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, in this next question, you don't have to answer it, but I have to ask it, because I've been wanting to ask it for a long time, but there is a rumor on the Internet that that you guys actually had some involvement making Siri.
Well, yeah, that's one that I can't answer. I mean, I have a very specific answer I can give. I can say that we provide some technology for some of the Apple products, but we really can't say more than that. So you can look around the Internet. You can't believe everything you read on the Internet, but certainly people have talked about that a fair amount, but I can't add any more comment than that, Justin.
Oh, that's fine, Peter, and I don't mean to put you on the spot here. I'm just trying to, you know, ask interesting questions, and I just thought that was an interesting, you know, topic, you know, because I was curious about it myself. So, but yeah, don't always believe what you see on the Internet, folks, because, you know, not all of it's true. So, but let's see, where else can we take this? Let me think of a good question here. Oh, how did you first get started with working with Dragon? What inspired you?
Well, that's a great question. You know, it's I'll tell you when I first. I'll tell you, the first time I got involved with assistive technology was back when I was in college in the 1980s. I worked at Boston College on a thesis project working on some communications technology. It was an input method for people who had limited ability to type. And that really inspired me to look into assistive technology over the time. I stepped away for it for a number of years, but then got back involved in Nuance because a very good friend of mine who I worked with for years worked at Nuance and knew he was looking for someone for a specific job, and he gave me a call and said, "Hey, would you consider working for this company?" And at the time, I guess it was about 2004, I really didn't know anything about Nuance. And it was actually called ScanSoft at the time. And I looked into it and said, wow, this is really an amazing, well-kept secret. I've got to learn more. I was very excited about it. And that's how I got involved. And I've been there since 2004. It's been an amazing place. At the time, we're about 10 times bigger than we were back then, so we've grown a great deal. And it's really been an amazing, amazing place to work.
Wow. And one of my last questions before we wrap things up here, because I've got a couple minutes left of the show, but I'm not going to keep you long, Peter, because I know that your schedule is, you know, vigorous at times. Where did the name Dragon come from?
Oh, that's a great question. So Dragon was actually originally the name of the company that made Dragon, and the company was called Dragon Systems. And there was a husband and wife. They're the Bakers were their name, and the husband who actually was mostly involved with the technology. He actually worked for IBM for years and was involved in research and speech technology. And he and his wife started the company to build a speech recognition product. And they really, what I hear because I don't know them. I never got the opportunity to meet them. What I hear is that they were really interested in Chinese art and artifacts, and they liked dragons. So they named the company Dragon Systems. And then what they ended up originally calling the product, they called it Naturally Speaking, because that's what it was supposed to do. So they called it Naturally Speaking. What we ended up doing over the years after we acquired the company is most people knew it as Dragon over the years. So we just said, hey, if they're going to call it Dragon, let's go with the flow and let's call it Dragon. So we've really de-emphasized the specific version name, Naturally Speaking. So if you look at the product, it still says Naturally Speaking for the Windows product, but it's in really small words because most people just know it as Dragon. We just like the name, and that's why we stuck with it over the years.
Yeah, it's an awesome name, actually, because I was curious. I was like, I wonder how they came up with that, because I'm into the Japanese and Chinese cultures, Peter, and martial arts and stuff, and I was like, maybe they got Dragon from that, but I was like, I'm going to find out, you know? I got to say that I want to go ahead and promote something that y'all do pretty much every Friday on Facebook and Twitter. Y'all do free giveaways of Dragon. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's a great. We love that program. So we really encourage everybody to to like us on Facebook, and you'll find that every Friday we have a Fan Friday giveaway, and we ask usually kind of a simple, usually pretty silly question, and then we pick someone randomly who responded and give away a free copy of Dragon. So it's a great way to encourage a discussion with our customers, and we love to get more and more people using Dragon. So thanks for pointing it out, Justin. I think it's a great way for people to hear about what's going on with Dragon and learn more.
Absolutely, folks, and it's a great birthday present. Christmas gift, graduation gift, or just a gift to say I love you. You know, I mean, Dragon's just that great of a gift. It's good for any occasion. So, I mean, that's one of the things that makes Dragon so special. So, before I let you go, Peter, is there anything that you would like to promote, or promote your pages and your final thoughts? Or
no, I think you sent folks for our Facebook page, so I appreciate that. No, I just wanted to thank you, Justin. I know you've been a long time follower and fan of Dragon, and we really appreciate it, and really appreciate you spreading the good word. I know you talk about Dragon a lot. I'm just thrilled to be part of your show and thrilled that Dragon can help you in your life.
Oh, absolutely, Peter. And I wanted to tell you, Peter, don't be a stranger, Peter. And if you ever need any type of promoting done, any type of promotion for Dragon or Nuance, let me know, and I'll be happy to plug it on the show.
I appreciate it, Justin.
And thank you for your time, Peter. And I'm sure we'll be talking again in the future.
All right, sounds good. Thanks again. Have a good day.
Thank you. And folks, that was Peter Mahoney. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. I know I did. I learned a lot about Dragon that I didn't even know. So, but I'm going to end tonight's show with a song by my friend Black Hawk Walters. This song is Indian Reservation. Thank you for listening to J-Ray Radio. See you guys again soon.
In 1830, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act. The Seminoles, Creeks, Choctaw, Chickasaw, and the Cherokee were marched to the Indian Territory of Oklahoma. Over 1/4 of our people died on this trail. To my people, it is known as the Trail of Tears. They took the whole Cherokee Nation, put us on this reservation, took away our ways of life, the tomahawk and the bow and knife, took away our native tongue, and taught their English our young, and all the beads we made by hand are nowadays made in Japan. Cherokee people, Cherokee tribe, so proud to live,
get over here!